sports, which is something that, since I've been doing the radio show, we haven't touched on. But it is a big element, I think, for women and certainly for lesbians. There's what we could call a dyke community of, well, let me rephrase that. Sports dykes. Is that a term?
Yeah. I guess ice dykes in my case.
Ice dykes. Yeah, in this particular case, and. We've got a lot to talk about, so we thought that in terms of order, we might go back to adolescence and this, the whole sports thing and the tomboy thing that happens for a lot of women, because as Nat said, she played hockey before she knew she was a dyke, so it seems like a logical place to start. And I think one of the prominent factors about sports is that it's a male-identified activity.
Yeah, and the disappointing thing was when you say going back to when it started, is that like my father, and who was really interested in hockey and loved it as much as I did, if I had been a boy, would have pushed, you know, would have gotten me into hockey school, et cetera, et cetera. But then it was like we shared it, watching the games on television, and that's about as far as it went. For the rest, I was out there playing outside. He didn't come and watch.
Did he play with you? Did he play hockey with you sometimes?
Not really that much. A little bit. But I'm sure if I would have been a boy, it would have been much more.
He would have pushed you.
Yeah. And it's frustrating now, because now, at the point I am now, I wonder, like, could I have been better had I had hockey school and been in leagues at an earlier age? I'll never know, you know.
So. Yeah, because we were talking about that. Well, we've been talking about hockey since 5:30. And covering a lot of ground. So, first of all, to set the context, you play for a small town team.
Yeah. Well, when I started out, the rink was right across the street, so I was there from 8 in the morning until my parents came and got me by the hair, you know. So, and the first organized team that I started playing in was when they had winter carnivals and things like that. And but it wasn't until I was at least 14, 15 in high school where I got into a team, and I had to settle for ringette.
No, it wasn't even women's hockey, it was women's ringette.
Yeah, that's, you know, you had to settle for that.
Did you feel like you were making quite a compromise then?
Yeah, because I really hated it. I don't like ringette that much, especially as a goalie, because the forwards have way too much control with that thing. You can't poke it away from them or anything. So, and then, well, it's the women that in my area, I'm in the country also, that put together a league. You know, I mean, we weren't going to wait around for the men to do it, because we still wouldn't be playing. So, and in the country, there's a lot of sports because there's not that much else to do.
Right, that's what you were saying, that there'll be those sports teams winter and summer, just as activity to get out and.
Yeah. So there's a lot of dykes in the hockey, but in the country, there are more heterosexual women playing, just because they want to get together and get out of the house and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the city, there are more dykes.
To get back to the to when you were an adolescent, the fantasy thing, because as you're saying, you were playing on the hockey rink from 8 in the morning until your parents dragged you home.
Yeah, and won in my mind cup after cup.
Superstar. Well,
bring the Tupperware bowl over there and hoist it over.
Did you?
You know, we just put that on the snowbank and play. First team who scored 10 goals would win the Tupperware Bowl.
Who were you playing with? Were you playing with other women, or were you playing with boys?
It was all boys. I was the only woman there. And what happened is I'm a goalie, and how I got into that was, let me make a comparison. When we were talking a while ago, it might be kind of funny, but I compare it to being a dyke. You know, you know that you're a dyke, but you play het. Because you have to, or you feel you have to, and you keep looking back and saying, I want to be over there with the dykes, you know. And that's what it was like to be a goalie, is I was playing forward, but I kept looking back at the net, knowing that that's where I really wanted to be. But everybody thought it was you had to be a little nuts to be in the net, so you didn't go, you know. But finally, when I realized it was all boys, and we would pick teams, you know, and they'd say, well, I'll take this one and that one. I was always the last one picked. Mm-hmm. So being the last one picked, I soon realized that if I went in the nets, first of all, I'd be much happier. And second of all, goalies are hard to come by. So they would pick me first, because everybody needs a goalie. So, you know, so I started. I started to feel more important too, you know. I wasn't always picked last because I was a girl. I was picked first because you needed a goalie, so, and nobody wanted to do it.
They started picking you first?
Well, nobody wanted to do the dirty job, you know, so.
Yeah, was it more of a question of that goalie equipment costs a lot more because you need a lot more padding and stuff, or were you guys even using padding?
Well, no, not at that time, no. But, no, that wasn't really, it was just that, especially since we didn't have equipment, it hurts. Nobody wants to be in there, you know.
And what about your thoughts about how, well, were you going to play hockey for the rest of your life, as far as you were concerned, as an 8-year-old?
Well, I would say that I would, you know, I'd say I was going to go, but in the back of my mind, I knew there was a limit, you know, and especially with my father's reaction and my mother too, you know, I was like, well, this is a fun thing, but you're going to have to get on to something else. And I remember telling my father, I said, I don't care. I'm going to play. I wanted to play in a communist country. I didn't know then what it was. What I meant was I could see the Canada Cup and the big rivalry between the Canada and the Soviet Union. And that was the ultimate in hockey. It was the best teams in the world. So I told him, I said, I want to go and play over there. And I did it. You know, it was maybe not... It's not a professional tournament, but that was one of my biggest dreams when I was little, and that's I finally did
it. So you did realize that, yeah. It's just, I suppose, at some point, especially as a child, you know, you're thinking, well, I'm good at this, I want to do this, and
yeah,
men make money at this, so maybe I can too. Although, as we were discussing earlier again, you know, it's just that somewhere in the back of your mind, you know that actually that's not really true.
It's not going to happen.
And... you know, the boys that you played with and the boys that I played hockey with as well, they were allowed to dream all they wanted about playing in the NHL. I mean, the fact is you've got to be, you know, pretty good to get into the NHL anyway, but at least they can they hang on to their dreams
the
a bit longer.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know, actually, which is healthier, you know, in fact, because perhaps they spend longer time deluding themselves. Or. But, you know, to some extent, anyway, we do.
But even if they don't make it, they can make it much higher than
well,
than
there
we can.
Are teams to play on, and there's
a lot of
levels, and they fit in there somewhere. But women, what are your options as far as teams go? I mean, you can. What's the highest level?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of places that you have to play that are like, for men they have A, AAA, they have B and C, you know, different calibers like that. All the A's are together. All the B's are together. For women, there's not as many women playing, so what they do is they mix up. They have two A's in each team, two B's in each team. So you have all these calibers in one league. So you have some very weak players and very strong players, and you don't get as good. The hockey's not as good, you know, and the weaker players are slowing down the stronger players. Then we don't advance as quickly.
So in other words, there's a women's league. And never mind what the categories.
That's it. That's it. In a lot of places, not everywhere. Okay, there are, but like more now it's more and more divided by caliber, and but when I started, it was anyone who wanted to play.
Mm-hmm.
So there were times like now it's getting a lot more fun, for me because I can play with people in my caliber. But there were times when I was extremely bored, because the caliber was just, you know, either I was too weak or too strong or whatever.
You were describing to me before one of the highlights of your hockey playing days, and that was playing with the women from the
that won the Canadian tournament.
Yeah,
they I'm sure a lot of Dykes have heard about it. The Canadian tournament in Ottawa was the first world tournament that was officially accepted by the Hockey Federation. You know, and there was a tournament in Dorval, and these girls, this team showed up, the Canadian team. And they're the best in the world. And I didn't know that they were there. We had a team, but we weren't that good. And we played 3 games in one day, and I played against this team. And I got something like 160 shots in 3 games and allowed 10 goals.
Which is a fabulous record.
Which I just couldn't believe, because when I first saw these girls, it was France Saint-Louis, who's the best in the world. And I'm just looking at these girls, and I'm starstruck. You know, like I was just happy to be there. You know, even if they had all the shots had gotten by me, I was there. But to have done that well, I think I saw, well, this is probably as good as it's going to get, as high as I can go.
Let's jump back 100 years.
Oh, yeah, you mean in the women's teams, yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned that before. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, there was hockey for women. There was a lot of women's teams in the 1800s, and it was quite popular. But what happened is as soon as the arenas came in, they thought that, you know, you had to pay for the ice time, etc., and men's hockey was much more important, so that since there's only so many hours that you can rent the ice, men got priority, and women, well, rather than play outside and all, they gave it up eventually, just became spectators. But
And we don't learn anything about that, so we sort of believe that women never played hockey, and so naturally
until
don't.
Until recently, but it's not the case.
And you were also telling me about a woman who's made it to Junior B.
Oh, yeah, there was a 19-year-old woman, Manon Réaume. She, you have to get accepted in the training camp. Then you get accepted on the team. So she made the training camp. She's a goaltender. And there was 6 goalies accepted, and 3 were sent back. And she was one of the 3 sent back. She was the second one sent back. And she did extremely well. But her problem, the reason they sent her back, they said, is that she was not used to an 80-game schedule. Which is another problem that we have, you know, besides not having hockey school and all that, is that we don't have seasons with 80 games, because we still to this day cannot get enough ice time.
Mm-hmm.
Men get priority.
Right.
So she had never had an 80-game schedule, and they were afraid that she would run out of steam somewhere down the line, so they sent her down, but they still think that she's good enough to make it, and she should keep working and keep up her shape, and she can probably make it. She did play one game.
That's incredible.
So that's one level before the NHL. And you see, this woman who's 19, she's in the age, in the generation that she had the hockey school, and she played with the boys, which we weren't allowed to do.
Right, because it's a fairly recent development that adolescent girls are allowed to play with adolescent boys.
And you can see the results, because women are getting into, there's the world tournament that happened, and now this woman is making it, and the next Olympics will have women's hockey. All due to the fact that we're getting the same training and the same chances.
Yeah, yeah. Let's touch on what should we touch on? The politics of lesbianism within your sport. And the relationship between dykes and straight women on the team. How out can you be?
You can't. Well, I'm out. And I'm the only one, I think. That, except for in Czechoslovakia when we went to that tournament, everybody was out, but who cares, we weren't even in a
we're in another country, let's be out.
That's it, you know, who cares, nobody knows us, so everybody was out. But as far as the other leagues that I'm playing in, I seem to be the only one that's out, and the thing is, we all go to the same bar after the game, you know, and but there, it's very frustrating, because the few straight women that are there, because there might be maybe 3 or 4 out of the whole team that are straight, and they are controlling everything, because everyone's making homophobic and lesbophobic jokes. And because of these 3 or 4 straight women, you know, that are there. And
Everybody's trying to be straight then, to sort of like fall in line with these 3 or 4 straight women.
Yeah.
And how many women are on the team?
Maybe 20, 25.
So there's 25 women, and because of 3 or 4, everybody's pretending that they're straight.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, there's a bigger picture. I don't think it's just the 3 or 4 women. I think it's the whole structure of the sports, of the hockey team, of the arena, just the whole male identity. And also what we were talking about earlier, too, Nat, was the idea that maybe being on a sports team, maybe these straight women are conscious
of how many dykes are there.
How many dykes are there?
They don't
want
to pass.
No, and they don't want to pass for a dyke.
That's
right?
It. That's exactly it. Yeah.
And so they're dealing with that by going the other extreme and making lesbophobic jokes and sure, I play on a hockey team, but I'm not a dyke. Don't accuse me of being a dyke.
Yeah, that's what happens.
And the irony must be just incredible to see some of your teammates in a
not my business to drag people out of the closet,
right.
You know, so I can't really do that. But I have come out when they've made a joke and say, hey, look, you're talking about me here, you know, and
mm-hmm.
that's not cool.
Mm-hmm.
So that has happened, that I've come out on that, but I don't take anyone else out of the closet. I do give them some wicked stares, though, like, don't you dare even think about saying some kind of joke, you know. So.
And you're an out dyke. How do they feel about you, then, on the whole?
They seem to look at me as they admire. And I look at them like, yeah, but you're a dyke. You know, this joke goes for you too.
How much do you think this has to do with the small town aspect?
A lot. Yeah. A lot, definitely. Yeah. Because, I mean...
Maybe on a city team.
Yeah, I've played in the city. It's much better. It's not... Well, there's still a lot of... I don't know where this closet thing comes in sports. I really don't. I mean, you would think that would be the place where it's most obvious.
Well, in some ways, I guess it is. But, I mean, maybe that's just it. They don't like to be labeled that way. Because I think sports... a sports team is a pretty legitimate environment to interact with women.
Right? Yeah,
You can be with women, and it's perfectly legitimate.
It'll pass.
Yeah, it'll pass.
Yeah.
However, the coaches are usually men, and I think maybe that this is a part of the problem. If they had dyke coaches or women coaches, it might be a little different.
Well, there are some men, but I've seen a lot of dyke coaches who are just as much in the back of the closet as the rest of the players, so it's the same thing for them.
Yeah, it's rather like the dyke gym teachers that we all had in high school.
They're all,
not all of them, but some of them definitely come to mind, you know?
Yeah.
Wow.
No, but I mean, they were all closeted, as far as I remember, my gym teachers, so.
Same sort of thing. How many women coaches are there in relation to men?
Well, I can only speak from my experience, and there's a little less than half. Mm-hmm. It's not bad. It's pretty even.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I prefer them because they take us more seriously. You know, the men, they'll just kind of change the lines, not teach us too much.
It must be interesting, too, because it's somewhere along the line, some of the male coaches must. I mean, I'm making a bit of a generalization, but maybe there's a feeling of... intimidation. You're women threatening the male club here, the boys' club. You know, here are these gals, and they're playing fine hockey. And, I mean, it's interesting that they don't teach you what maybe they ought to be teaching you.
They don't teach us because they just don't think we can learn. Think that we don't care to learn. We're just out there to play, and it's just for fun. It's the same thing with this woman that made it to the junior team. The article in the paper stated how good she was and gave all these positive things about her. And at the end of the article, there was it ended with, well, she's very good, but she does realize that a hockey is no place for a woman, which is why she's going back to her studies and she wants to be a teacher.
And she's had her stint with the hockey. That's and she's it. Very good, but...
You should be happy with that now, you know?
We're going to go to a musical break, and we'll be right back. We're back. 5 more minutes. We've got lots to cover, so we're just going to move right along. The aspect of play, how women play the game.
Well, I think they can get pretty violent, like the men, but I think it's from watching men's hockey. We've had no representation from other women. We don't, you know, we've learned to play by watching men. So they do get a little rough sometimes, but...
I guess it's that male-identified thing and machismo that...
But what happens is, I remember, it starts very, very young. When I was a kid, I wanted to play... since I wanted to play hockey and I seemed to be the only woman around that wanted to play, I had to play with the men. So... And they didn't accept me, so I had to find a way for them to accept me uh-huh. so that I could get on the team so that I could get to play. Uh-huh. So it's all this conniving just to get to play the game. If I would just be allowed to play, period, there would be no problem. But I had to do all this, and in order to get accepted, I realized I had to act like them.
Yeah.
And
be one of the boys.
Be one of the boys. And this was all just, it wasn't really me, but it was all just to get to play the game. So that's how it starts. And the next thing you know, you don't realize it, and you're a completely changed person. You're a macho pig. it's that simple. And it's the same thing. You see it when we're playing. You see that there's a clique. There's the players and their girlfriends. The girlfriends are sitting in the stands, and it's like the players' wives kind of thing. That's what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And all the dykes that play are you know, making the same kind of jokes that men make about their girlfriends, etc. And I don't really like that kind of thing, and fortunately, being a goalie, we're always looked upon as different right from the start.
Right,
and
you're
weird.
We're allowed to be eccentric.
Yeah. We're allowed to, yeah. And if we're different, if we don't go out with the girls after the game, oh, well, it's just the goalie. You know how they are. So I get a sense that I'm not liked. I am very macho because it happened, like I just explained. But I'm trying to get out of it, and I really don't like that way of thinking. So I don't go out much after the games with the girls, but it's very mm-hmm. accepted because I'm a goalie and I'm weird, you know. So they don't make a big deal of it.
Yeah. I wanted to touch on, too, we don't have much time left, but the attitude, because you live out in the country and you play hockey for a smaller team, but then you come into the city quite a lot, too, and there's no doubt that, you know, there's sort of a contemptuousness for jocks. I think that's kind of a broad statement, but there is an attitude. Do you feel that from other lesbians who look down on sports?
Yeah, well, it's because we're macho.
Mm-hmm.
And
male-identified, and
yeah.
They see it all as negative.
Yeah, and the thing is that the jocks themselves don't even realize it, because when I talk to them about it, when I talk to my teammates about it, they look at me like they don't know what I'm talking about, you know? It's become so much a part of their lives now, they don't even realize it. So, and a lot of other dykes that I want to... I want to get interested in other subjects and things. All they talk to me about is hockey, and I want to know about feminism and all kinds of other things, and they seem to not know what to say to me because they think that all we think about is hockey, mm-hmm. you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's all we know, and so we don't get much chance.
And as if they can't, they then can't relate to you because, you know, you are a jock, and so that is your persona, and they are whoever they are, and you don't have anything
but
in common. And
I can understand that,
yeah.
because even I, as a jock, have problems relating to other jocks because
mm-hmm.
I know that I have the same misconceptions about that everyone else has, like, towards me, so.
Well, I hate to end it, so I think you'll have to come back sometime in between seasons.
There is no in-between season for me.
Well, you
but
have,
yeah,
have
I'd like to come back.
Seasons.
Yeah,
thank you
days.
Very much, Nat.
Thank you.
I have a little introduction, though. Seeing as universities are opening up for business, the streets and the clubs and cafes are flooded with new and returning students, the first week or so of classes means orientation week. And that traditionally focuses on beer bashes and pub crawls and other clever ways of getting to know one's university, its city, and people. This year at Concordia, things are being run differently. Last year's CUSA elections saw two women elected as co-presidents on a Feminism Works platform. Among other changes, there will be no bashes or pub crawls per se this year. The new handbook contains words of wisdom from the co-presidents on what feminist ideology and practice is all about. There's an introduction of 8 pages debunking the standard glossy Canadian historical interpretation of a country, in fact, colonially conquered. I don't know if that's a word, but it's a good alliteration. With racist, sexist, and homophobic intent. There's a 12-page section on women's issues, though no mention of women of color. A 16-page section focusing on the we're here, we're queer, get used to it aspect of lesbian and gay visibility. And it looks pretty good. The cover actually is pretty funny. It's people walking up the escalator stairs, which is a perpetual problem at Concordia, because there are escalators that supposedly take you up to the 12th floor, but often you've got to walk many of those stairs. The handbook, as far as I'm concerned, it may be just a bit too clickish. There are perhaps one too many photos of the club in there. But on the whole, it should be an interesting year at Concordia. Some people were already getting all stirred up about the content of the handbook. It should be about Concordia, not feminism. And they were getting a fair bit of that, so I imagine that letters to the link editor will be full of that this year. Despite the many positive goings on, I couldn't help but notice some distressing irony amidst all the smugness. Last week, Mackay Street was closed to traffic in the afternoon between Sherbrooke and de Maisonneuve, and a stage was set up for music and comedy acts, as well as all sorts of tables dispensing information on the various clubs and organizations at Concordia. The Gay and Lesbian Friends of Concordia had a table set up near the stage. They were handing out pamphlets, being visible, being out. Lots of fags and dykes dropped by, hung out, chatted. On Wednesday afternoon, 20 feet away from them, on the stage, Trey Sitter, a lesbian singer-songwriter who's appeared on the show a couple of times, was singing her heart out about lesbian love and other related topics, mainly to a distracted straight crowd. Do you think the fags and dykes who were so busy being out gave her any support? Nope. In fact, they barely paid attention. We ought to respect each other on many fronts, folks. Musical taste aside, at the very least, some acknowledgement would be nice. Self-serving visibility is not overly useful, and that's just an observation. So, Tracy, welcome.
Hi.
Now, you were in the Gay Games and the San Francisco bodybuilding competition.
The International Gay and Lesbian Bodybuilding Championship. Yeah.
Championship, okay.
In San Francisco. This June?
This past June.
Yeah.
Let's just go back a little bit to kind of beginnings. How did you get interested in bodybuilding? How did you start?
Well, I sort of started in CJEP. I took a course in weight training, and I really found a sport that was for me. I really hadn't done any sports in high school or anything like that, no track, no basketball. And I started doing weights in CJEP, and the teacher was really encouraging, and I found a sport that I could do on my own, and you know, it was really pretty easy to equip yourself, and I started training in my own garage and that. And from training in school, I started training in gyms and stuff like that.
And why didn't you play sports? I'm just sort of curious. What was it about that?
I was too busy studying. Yeah, I was just really into the books when I was younger, and I just never really took the time to participate in sports. I really loved sports, and I played a lot at home, like on the street and stuff like that. I really loved football, and I'd skateboard and cycle and stuff like that. And I was always like very active in that, but I never really got into organized sports in school and that. I was always, you know, just too busy studying.
And as you said, you know, bodybuilding being, you could do it on your own. It's individual, and it's not a team sport, and those sort of, you don't have
when I started training, I trained a lot on my own, and then my father, it really encouraged me, and I really sort of got him back into training, because he had been a bodybuilder when he was a teenager, and he realized how interested I was in it, and I sort of got him to come back into the gym and start training himself really in a rigorous way, and he gave me a lot of encouragement in continuing the sport and sort of going to a higher level.
So how many years now have you trained?
I've been training 8 years now.
And your dad encourages you to this day, I suppose.
Oh yeah, yeah. He I share all my contests with him. I bring home the videos and the pictures,
and he's right into it.
Yeah.
Speaking of pictures,
we were going to share them with you on air, but unfortunately, they don't translate.
They don't translate at all. But some of them are amazing, and that, I mean, immediately when one sees pictures like that, it's bodybuilding as a sculpture, a body as a sculpture. And from the training that you described as well, it's your body as a machine as well, a very well-tuned machine by the sounds of it.
Yeah, I think it really comes down to the line when you're competing the month before the contest. And you may have been dieting sort of gradually for maybe 3 months before the contest, but the month before the contest, you really sort of cut out any sort of superfluous items from your diet, your nutritional regime. You sort of cut out all the sort of fats and salt and simple carbohydrates. So you're basically not eating any sugar, you're not eating any butter, you're not eating anything with any salt in it, and you're basically preparing your own food all the time, and you're drinking copious amounts of water, and you're continuously like going to the bathroom maybe 4 times every hour or so. But you feel really good. Your body, you really clean a lot of the toxins out of your body. You flush it out with a lot of the water and the good food. You eat a lot of broccoli and leguminous vegetables, and it just cleans your system completely out, and your skin has this glow, and you know, all your acne and everything clears up, and you just feel amazing.
Are you sure your skin's not glowing because of that oil you put on?
No, you don't wear the oil all the time. I mean, you get kind of greedy in your clothes if you wore this posing oil every day. But no, you take care of your skin, and the food that you eat really shows up in your skin and your body. And
but the training and the diet, that's pretty much a constant if you're at all serious about bodybuilding and competing.
Well, I think there are different levels of dieting throughout the year depending on when you want to compete. And right now I'm in my off season, and I'm not planning to compete until the spring, so I'm being kind of lax about my diet. Ever since I finished competing in San Francisco, I've sort of been eating almost nonstop. And I gained 17 pounds from the competition till now, and I'm just starting to re-regulate my diet and sort of get a lot stricter about the simple carbohydrates, because that's my thing, chocolate and sugars that really get me and sort of promote the water retention and weight gain. And so right now I'm just sort of cutting down on the amount of simple carbohydrates that I've been taking in, sort of trying to hone in for a goal, a vision of the springtime, and I'm planning to compete in the Miss Montreal.
And that's when? In May?
In the spring, yeah. It's early May, usually.
Earlier, describing the differences between the men's version of the sport and the women's version of the sport, so I wonder if you could share that with our audience.
Well, I think I've competed in 2 gay and lesbian competitions and 1 straight competition, and the straight competition was in November, and it was the Espoir. And I found that the competitors in the gay and lesbian competitions are a lot more friendly. Like, there's a sense of community, like gay and lesbian bodybuilder community. There's a sort of factor of getting to know everybody who's competing and sort of, you know, making friends and communicating with these people on a certain level. And I found in the straight competition, the women that were competing against me, we were really competing against each other, and there was, you know, there was less commonality of experience and sort of willingness to share your experiences and stuff like that, and trade secrets, and, you know, what you do, your diet, because there are different variations, different people do different things, and different things work for different people. So there was less of that kind of sharing and that enrichment of the whole experience, and I really got a lot more value of the gay and lesbian bodybuilding competitions, and I would really continue competing in those type of competitions over the straight competitions, you know.
Oh, and what's, I suppose, next, you said the San Francisco Gay and Lesbian Championship happens every year.
Yes.
You're going to do that again next year, too?
Well, I'd like to. Depending if I could get financial backing, I think about it if I could get financial backing, but right now I'd really like to focus on some sort of local recognition in the Montreal, because I was born here in Montreal, and, you know, it's my town, and I'd really like some recognition on that level. But I would love to go to San Francisco again. It was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. There was, the day after the competition, we were in the Gay Pride competition, parade actually. There was, everybody in the competition had their float, and we were up on a float posing for the crowds, and there were like 500,000 people from all over the world, and it was really incredible. You know, it was pretty big.
All watching you pose.
Yeah. Yeah, and dance. We had a good time up on that float.
But what you're saying too about being recognized in Montreal, what's the competitive scene like in Montreal for women bodybuilders? How seriously is it taken, I guess, is what I'm asking.
I don't know. From what I've seen from the Espoir that I've competed in November, it seems that there aren't very many women competitors. It seems like the sport is dwindling in interest, or less and less women are competing. And mm-hmm. I went to the preliminaries for the Montreal in the spring. And there were not that many women. There were, like, you know, four women in the lightweight, three or four in the middleweight, and four or five in the heavy. And the men, there were so many. You know, there were, like, large categories of men. And I'm just wondering if these women are not just competing, and I don't know, because, you know, these competitions aren't taking them as seriously. I find that, I think, the women's competition, it's not of the same magnitude as the men's. You know, I think the money, you know, is not as much there for the women.
What percentage of the competition would be women-based, would you estimate, if you could?
You mean in a straight competition?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it'd be hard to say, but if you want to use any sort of comparison, like in the women's middleweight class in the Montreal, there were, I think, three or four women, and in the men's middleweight, there were like about 11 competitors, if I remember correctly, and in the light heavyweight men's, there were like 19, compared to the women's heavyweight, which I think there were five women. Five, it might have been. So if you want to use that as comparison in the same contest, I guess you can sort of figure out percentages from that.
And when you describe the Miss Montreal competition, that's just, that would be just women. It's not, there's no equivalent of men happening at the same time? Or
yes, there is. It's a mixed competition, okay. Actually. Yeah. Yeah, but the Montreal is sort of a pivotal contest, because if you qualify in the Montreal, you can go on to the provincials, the Quebec. And from the Quebec championship, you can go to the Eastern Canada and then the Canadian championships. So it's sort of stepwise. You qualify in one, you can go on to the next, and you qualify in that one, so forth.
What happens? How far can you get? You can go to the Canadian, to the nationals,
mm-hmm.
And then what awaits if you were to win at the nationals?
Well, when you go to the nationals, I think you can. There's an IFBB, which is the International Federation of Bodybuilding, and they have a competition every year that, if you qualify in this and win, if you place in this competition, you'll be deemed pro, and you get your sort of professional card, and you can, you know, train, do the professional circuit contests.
And does that involve money?
Yeah, that involves money. You finally sort of make back some of the money you spend on nutritional supplements and tanning and bathing suits and, you know.
Well, and the time spent as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, right now I'm doing this because I like it. It doesn't pay me. I just do it because it gives me a lot of satisfaction. I mean, just that minute or minute and a half or 3 minutes if you're in pairs up on stage in front of those people just going wild, it's just, it pays me back right there.
We're going to take a musical break, and we'll come back and talk about the shows. This is Carolyn by Frank, and it's about gym teachers. Thank you.
like you, and no one is quite as handsome as you are. Oh, Carolyn, I'm impressed by you. I wanna be strong as you, and I wanna lift the same barbells you do. 'Cause Carolyn, I wanna be strong like you. It's no small thing I've got. Got a crush on your everything. Carolyn, my friends, they can't stand it, 'cause I go for a swim instead of a drink, and I've started to wear polyester. So I cannot blame them for what they think. Carolyn, you make me want to be a gym teacher. You made me question being a folk singer, but I don't want to waste my life away at the sidelines in the bleachers.
Well, we're back. It's Dykes on Mics, and we're talking to a female bodybuilder. And so you chose that song. Why? Well, it reminds me when I started working out at a gym, and I had this a crush on my first woman bodybuilder, and I just admired the aesthetic so much, and I thought, wow, it just really sort of sublimated some of my energy in this inaccessible body, and started whipping myself into that kind of shape, you know. It was sort of like an ideal that I'd always had, and this woman sort of typified it for me, you know. And
I'm curious, because I was reading Spin magazine, and they mentioned Frank as being one of the more original voices in music today, alternative music today, and it's really fun, some of the topics she covers like that. She really sort of explodes some stereotypes.
Oh yeah, and she talks about swimming with the girls and stuff like that. Yeah, I really like her music. It's definitely got a sort of sports person, sports woman sort of feel to it, you know?
We were talking earlier about femininity in the sport and what it means to you, and as opposed to masculinity in the sport, because it's really male-dominated.
And male-identified, I guess.
Right. Well, for me, the issue of femininity is really bogus. I think that, well, I'm obviously a woman, I'm up there, and I'm posing, I'm bodybuilding as a woman. I'm not up there to ape a man or whatever, but I think in the straight bodybuilding world, there's a real major problem with that, especially with lesbianism. I think one of the problems with it is that, you know, a lot of men or people feel threatened when a woman sort of transgresses the bounds of what is expected of her, in that, you know, anybody can train with weights and develop muscles, but it's not something that women have been socialized to do. It's not something that they've been valued for. And from the time a woman starts to claim that territory, and it's really a lot of about control of your own body and what, you know, really direct control about your own strength and realizing, you know, what your body can do. And when I first started training, I just sort of really had this amazing high and this amazing lift in self-esteem and realizing how strong that I could be, and that I was a lot stronger than a lot of guys, because I would watch them training in the gym, and it was just like I shattered a lot of my own myths about strength and that. And I think part of the problem with lesbianism in the sport is that, and it's not a problem, but I think you have to be closeted, a lot of women find, I think, in straight contests that they have to be closeted, is that it's sort of like an old myth, you know, you're into sports, you must be a dyke. And I think it's the whole thing that you already are in a sort of a male, traditionally male type territory, and to be a dyke on top of it sort of confirms everybody's fears about you, and, you know, it makes the so-called sport look bad.
And it makes it even more intimidating, I guess, for the audience, and also for those involved, particularly the men, to not only see a woman sort of transgressing on their territory and building muscles and sort of being feminine but being masculine, but also to be a lesbian on top of it, for them must be quite intimidating.
With all those muscles, she just might want to kick his ass, and she might be able to do it. But, you know, the thing is, so many guys approach me in the gym and they say, you know, well, why do you want to be so strong? Do you want to beat up your boyfriend or something like that? And I said, honey, I just don't have the time, you know. Violence is just so anti-productive. I don't have the time to fight. I just want to look good, you know, and be strong. And so many men get the impression that you're doing weights and you want to get strong, it's because you want to fight, and you want to fight against them. They could never sort of, you know, come to the idea that maybe you just want to look good and you like being strong and you like big muscles, just for their, you know, for an aesthetic and for your own sake.
Not only that, but what we were talking about earlier too is the pleasure and the high even. That you get from doing it, from sculpting your body and from sort of tuning and...
Yeah, it's a really, really, really direct. There's a direct correlation between, you know, the weights and how often you train and the results. You see them. They're really concrete. It's, for me, it's one of the sports where you can really see the results. You know, if you're really dedicated and you do what you have to do according to your program, you see the results. You know, and you really do claim control of your body.
And when men, what you were just saying earlier about men sort of saying, well, you know, do you want to beat up your boyfriend? Is that what you want, muscles? I mean, can you ever throw it back at them and ask them why they're doing it too? I mean, is it somebody they want to beat up? Is that what they've got in their head? You know, that they've got to be real macho and real strong? And
yeah, I've never really thrown it back at them, but, you know, I'd
be sort of
Yeah, it would be really interesting. Yeah, I would really think of it. I usually just respond from a personal level and say, well, you know, I don't have the time. Mm-hmm. You know, and it throws them too, because
yeah,
they...
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you're sort of witty, you know? And
Yeah.
As a lesbian in the sport, you kind of touched on that. Now, when you describe the different shows, the straight shows and the gay and lesbian shows, and the camaraderie between the women that compete in gay and lesbian games and straight games, I mean, that's quite a difference, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for me, there was, in my experience of competitions, there's been a definite difference.
And, I mean, you sort of wonder, okay, that you're pretty closeted as far as straight competitions go.
When I went to my first competition, my first straight competition, for me, it didn't come up as an issue. But I'm not competing to be closeted.
I guess I'm just wondering about. I mean, it's not something that really has to be discussed or is discussed. It's just you're
right.
there competing. It's not
right.
really an issue.
Right.
But at the same time, you're kind of aware of the fact that, well, you're not going to say you're a lesbian. You're not going
to. Oh well, I would really love to win the Montreal and come out. You know, and on stage, and for me that would be a major statement. I have these dreams of doing that, and, you know, I think because it would shatter a lot of myths mm-hmm. of who we are, and you know, especially being a woman of color as well, and the whole lesbian invisibility for women of color, I think it would be a real coup. You know, if I could stand there on the stage and after my routine when I accept my medal come out and say, well...